Dynasty, and basically it's based on these four papers, some of them written with collaborators in various places. This was a collaboration where we started all of us close together, and we sort of dispersed around the country. And then this is my student, Sam Vasquez. I'm going to also talk a little bit about that paper. And then I also have to talk about the paper of Lin Dunin and others. And I think Peter Horava will also talk a little bit about that. So I'm going to be quick about that one. So I'm going to talk about the structure of how VPS plays in ADS-CFT. Well, what's the motivation? We have ADS-CFT, and we have a dual description of string theory in negatively curved spacetime. And then the idea is that this goes under the name of holography, and the most celebrated and unstudied case is any Polyanov theory. The duality between these two objects is a strong weak coupling duality for the truth coupling. So it's very hard to make computations on both sides and compare. But we've done a lot of progress in the past few years. We know a lot about closed strings in the CFT dual of ADS. They're described by traces. They seem to give rise to an integrable structure to all loops in perturbation theory. And there's very well-known limits, the BMN limit, semi-classic string, and supergravity, which corresponds to all BPS multiplets. So when I tell you that that it's a duality, it's really a duality at the level that the two theories are equivalent. And that means not just the perturbative objects, but also the non-perturbative objects should be there. So what are the easiest perturbative or non-perturbative objects in string theory? They're D-brains. So we can ask the question, what do we know about D-brains in ADS-CFT? We know some BPS states. Basically, I'm going to argue that we also know all supergravity solutions with one half of the supersymmetry. We know the low energy fluctuations for certain single D-brain states. We know how to add infinite D-brains, like defect CFT flavor. But to be honest, we really don't know very much about the dynamics of brain BPS, period. Many qualitative aspects are usually missing. So, for example, if I gave you the theoretical problem to find the dual operator that describes brains and angles, nobody has really written that down. And there's no paradigm for how to go about that. If you think about showing that the D-brains are D-brains in dual CFT, you have to argue that the gauge symmetry has to appear somehow in the dual description, and you have to understand how that shows up for compact D-brains. And you also want to be able to derive something like the Dirac-Bonnier effect fraction. Yes, for certain configurations of D-brains. For some situations, we know that. But we have to get the DBI action in with all the fluxes and everything like that, with all the monomer fluxes. So we have to do it a little bit better than the usual DBI action. So I'm going to tell you the plan for the talk. I'm going to talk a lot about half DPS D-brains in ADS 5.5. I'm going to tell you what their dual description is and how you try to get there. I'm going to show you that the correct description for these guys is that you need to study a system of free fermions, and you end up in the quantum Hall effect. And then I'm going to tell you something about how you showed that there's a gauge symmetry on the world volume of these D-brains. And then at the end, I'm going to tell you something about this paper of Lin Dunin and Maldacena about how to find the supergravity solutions corresponding to stacks of D-brains in various locations in ADS. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit of the questions that we're trying to explore. So let's start by the ADS-CFT correspondence. And I'm just going to do it for n equal 4 Yang-Mills theory. We start at type 2B string theory in flat 10 dimensions. We consider a stack of n parallel D3 brains located on top of each other, or sometimes separated just a little bit, but at a distance which is much smaller than the string scale. And then we're interested in understanding the degrees of freedom of the D-brain stack, which are very light. This means much, much lighter than the string scale. So when we look at that, there's just one answer, and this is based on supersymmetry. This is supersymmetric. You get n equal 4 Yang-Mills here. You can also look at it from the point of view of the fact that the D-brains are heavy objects, and they they change the geometry. So the D brings bent space-time, and you can also ask the low-energy effective theory there, but from the point of view of the closed strings. And what happens is that the solution that you associate to these D brains is going to look like a black brain. There's a horizon, and near the horizon, there's infinite redshift. And anything massive that you put there requires an infinite amount of energy to get out relative to the local energy. So from the point of view of infinity, these things cost very little to no energy, and they also are described in the infrared physics of the brain. And then you can take this area of the throat very near the horizon, and you obtain type 2B string theory on ADS5 cross S5 with n units of flux. So there's these two descriptions of the low energy dynamics. One is the D-brainy one, the other one is the geometric one. And the ADS-CFT correspondence is that there's a quantum equivalence between these two forms of taking the infrared dynamics on the collection of D-brains. So on the D-brain side, you get a supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory with n equal 4 supersymmetries. It's a conformal field theory, so the symmetry group is SU2 to 4. This includes all the supersymmetries. You have a gauge group, which is UN. You have a coupling constant. And then there's the Tuft coupling constant, which is G squared N. And on the supergravity side, you get the same symmetry group, SU2 to 4. The rank of the gauge group is replaced by the flux on the S5 of the supergravity solution. The coupling constant, the Yang-Mills coupling constant, is replaced by the closed string coupling constant. We know the dictionary between these two. And the radius of the ADS geometry in string units is exactly the Tuft coupling. And this is where all this strong weak conflict duality comes into place, because if R is large, then the Tuft coupling is large, and that's where you believe you can do supergravity analysis. And if R is small, then this is small, that's where you believe you can do field theory analysis. And now the last point, which is going to be very important and used throughout this talk, is that you have to be a little bit careful about observables, because you have a conformal field theory. So the usual observables of regular field theories, which are S matrices, are not really the most appropriate observables. And this is due to the fact that you can emit an infinite number of soft particles to obtain a state. So the type of observables that one uses, there's a lot of ways to do it. You need some type of infrared regulator. And if you go to Euclidean field theory, you can also find an infrared regulator from just considering operators separated by some distance. The distance between the operator and the correlation functions of those are observables. And if you take a conformal field theory, you can also do radial quantization. Radial quantization means that you can write the metric of your space in radial coordinates, and you notice that in radial coordinates, the metric is conformally equivalent to the metric of a round sphere times some time, which is radial time. So you do that conformal transformation, and because the theory is a conformal field theory, there's a relation between both types of systems. So you can label all states on S3 by operators inserted at the origin. This is the operator state correspondence, and we're going to use it throughout the rest of the talk without discrimination. So you have to keep track of the fact that when I say an operator, I also mean a state on S3, and when I say a state on S3, I also mean a dual operator. Okay. Now that we have this idea, I can tell you what the dictionary for supergravity states is. And this was developed by Witten, Gutzer, Klebanov, and Polyakov. The strings on ADS5 cross S5 are single trace operators in n equal 4 Yang-Mills theory. Supergravity states are all half BPS, and they can be understood as weak coupling because they are supersymmetric. They are descendants of trace of Z to the n, where Z is one of the complex scalars of the n equal 4 Yang-Mills theory. So with this in mind, I've already given you the dictionary for all supergravity states. And basically what I've given you is the representation theory associated to the conformal group of all of these objects. So I'm telling you what the highest weight state is under the conformal group, and then the rest can be obtained by actions of the conformal group. So this is where it all started. Now we look at the problem of B brains on AdS5, COSS5. So they are giant gravitons, or there exist these solutions that are giant gravitons. Let me phrase it in the following terms. Are there interesting heavy states in AdS5, COSS5, meaning something other than just gravitons? So the way you're supposed to take to attack this problem is that you fix n large, but do not take the infinite n limit. So we're not doing the Tuft expansion anymore. We're fixing n to be large. And then there's some algebraic property of traces that they're only algebraically independent up to order n. So trace of z to the n plus 1 is a polynomial in trace of z to the k. This is a fact for n by n matrices. This upper limit on traces is some type of cutoff on the number of graviton states you can have. So this is called the stringy exclusion principle because it somehow is telling you that gravitons don't go all the way to arbitrarily small scales and arbitrarily fast rapidities. The idea of Susskind is that if you take a string with a lot of energy, let's say of order n, they have to grow transversely in their direction of motion. The reason for that is that if they would not, then you would think that there's too much energy localized on a small region and it would form some type of black hole. So to avoid making a black hole, these things would have to grow somehow. And we could try to look for a D-brain solution which represents this growth. So this is exactly what McGreevy, Susskind, and Tombaugh did. They said, OK, let's start with a D3-brain wrapping around S3 in S5 and give it a lot of angular momentum on the S5. And you can actually find dynamically stable solutions of this kind. You can also show that they preserve half of the supersymmetries. And their idea was that the size of the S3 inside the S5 is something that tells you that these D-brains can only be so big. And this was their conjectured solution to this stringy exclusion principle, that all of these traces would be exactly these S3s and that they would match in the end the maximal size inside the S5. And the name they gave for these brains is giant gravitons because as far as quantum numbers go, they are completely indistinguishable from gravitons except that these are big fat D brains. And let me give you a little bit more of an idea of why these things are stable. Well, the effective action of the D brains is of the Dirac-Born-Infeld type. You get the volume of the D brain, and then you also get the pullback of the flux potential. So the D brains are coupled to the flux, and the presence of the flux gives some type of magnetic field under which the D brain is coupled. So if you give the D brain some speed, there's some Lorentz force between the velocity and the magnetic field, which prevents the D brain from collapsing. So this is how the giant gravitons are stable. The surprise was that there is another giant graviton. This one wraps an S3 inside AdS5 and has a lot of angular momentum also along the S5. And it's also dynamically stable, but this is due to electric fields as opposed to magnetic fields. It also preserves half of the supersymmetry. And this was the work of Hashimoto, Hirano, and Itzaki, and Grisaru, Myers, and Tashford. Okay. So in any case, it turns out that the solution to the puzzle turned out to be doubled, and then there was the issue of what is the right solution. We have to be careful. It turns out that we need to start, go back a little bit, and analyze the problem from the beginning again. The giant gravitons have an energy of order n. And they have to be built out of the same type of ingredients than other half BPS states. They have to be described as operators which are descendants of, we started with single traces of Z, but multi-traces of Z also have the same type of property than single traces of Z, meaning that they're also half BPS operators. So in principle, the one place where the description was somewhat shaky was in assuming that the description in terms of traces was arbitrarily good to this order. So traces turn out not to be a good description for operators of these energies, because they don't give rise to orthogonal states. And the reason is that when you have energy of order n, the 1 over n suppressions from planar diagrams are overwhelmed by the fact that you have of order n quanta that interact. So you have to be a lot more careful in finding your basis of states, and we need to look for a better description of the operators. It doesn't tell you that you can that you can't find them as single traces. It tells you that it's not necessarily true that they should be single traces. Single traces is the correct description for strings when the amount of momentum that you have is much smaller than n, meaning of order 1 with respect to n.
I think that's the strongest. For a small number of operators, you're pretty much guaranteed the eigenstates of the dilatation operator will be single trace, or will be characterized by trace, because trace is a conserved quantum number. There's an operator which counts the number of traces that commutes with the dilatation operator. Once you get to large traces, it's no longer true. And so you simply don't expect that operators have a definite dimension.
It commutes only to order 1 over n.
Right.
Yeah, this is the.
Yeah.
So, what happened was that, Javicki and collaborators gave a complete basis of these states. They said they're provided by Schur polynomials. The way they argued is that you have to think of Z as an operator-valued matrix in the adjoint of the group UN, and you can really consider Z as a generic matrix of GL and C. And then you can take the trace in a representation of the group which is not the fundamental. So this is a character basis for different representations of the group UN. And then you can classify all the reducible representations by using Young tableau with columns of length less than or equal to UN. Yes? They basically say that this is a complete basis of VPS states, one for each tableau. So of this tableau, which represent giant gravitons growing on S5 and into ADS5? So the first ones were conjectured by DJ and Matt and Miha Berkus and
Asad
Naqvi, based on their better orthogonality properties, meaning that determinants or subdeterminants, which are these guys, are objects which have better orthogonality properties at large n. And then the second set, these ones over here, which do not have an upper bound, which are the ones that can go into ADS, were conjectured by Javicki and collaborators exactly based on symmetry of the Young tableau, that the Young tableau behave pretty similar when you flip them across the diagonal. And the main statement is that columns can go down only up to order n, so these should be the ones that grow into ADS, and rows can grow indefinitely, so these are the ones that can grow into ADS5, because in ADS5 it's a non-compact space, you can grow arbitrarily large brains. So now we use the operator state correspondence again, and if you are a little bit more careful about it, you can understand these states in the Fock space of the n equal 4 theory compactified on S3. So I've given you these operators, and I'm telling you that I can do a little bit better than that. I can describe them in terms of the Fock space of n equal 4 Young-Lens theory on S3. We use the letter Z now to indicate a particular raising operator for the S wave of the field Z on S3. So the reason why you know that this has to be the case is because the field Z have no SO4 quantum numbers under rotations. It's a scalar operator. So it should be invariant under SO4 rotations, and the only invariant which has this R charge is exactly this S wave mode. So when you look at this from the point of view of n equal 4 compactified on S3, all the states that we're talking about are built out of this S wave mode. I'm going to make another. Yes? We're not ignoring the gauge fields. They just don't have R charge. So they would contribute to the dimension, but not to the R charge, and they will not saturate the VPS bound.
So you don't build operators.
Well, they have to be gauge invariant.
Right,
yeah, but A0 is not a dynamical variable. It imposes the Gauss constraint. Right? When you do the field theory on S3, there's, let's say, the physical quanta of the gauge field, and then there's also the Gauss constraint. The one that imposes the Gauss constraint is A0, which is a non-dynamical field, meaning that there's no canonically conjugate momenta. And that one survives.
But there are also the
others. But the other ones are contribute to energy, but not to R charge, so they wouldn't produce BPS states. They're going to be under ground state. Descendants are derivatives at this point. These are higher spherical harmonics of Z on S3. Yeah, in the full superconformal group, the F mu nu can also appear as a descendant of the field Z. But that's after you apply four supersymmetries or something like that. Right? We're talking about highest weight states, and we're just looking at the highest weight states. So all states that we're talking about are built out of this S-wave mode. And I'm going to make this assumption, which is fairly common in supersymmetric situations. And I'm telling you it's this assumption because it hasn't really been proved to work to all orders. Because the states are BPS, we can integrate out all other fields. And there are no quantum corrections to the effective action of the S-wave mode on of these fields.
Sorry to belabor this, but what does it mean if you try and stray away from these absolutely BPS configurations? You can't do it by just endowing Z with some extra excitations. You have to then also...
Yeah, you have to include everything else. Okay. Yes. Okay. So if we're just sticking to the half BPS guys, this is all right. So... Well, it's the physical one just for the half BPS states, but not for anything else.
Okay,
so the question is, what is the effective dynamics of these modes? They're built out of the S wave of Z. So it has to be the dynamics of a matrix-valued harmonic oscillator. That's what Z is. And it has to be gauged because we still have the Gauss's constraint. We still have to have a gauge invariant state. Now, the reason why it's a harmonic oscillator is because the terms of the potential that could possibly contribute are actually zero on these states. The commutator square terms actually vanish. So all you're left over with for these guys is the kinetic term. And you also have to remember that N equal 4 Yang-Mills theory is a conformal field theory, which means that all the scalars, when you're compactified on a curved manifold, have to be conformally coupled to the S3, and that means that you get some induced mass term from the curvature. And you just normalize it to 1. And then the effective dynamics of all of these modes is just a gauged quantum mechanics of the harmonic oscillator. Okay? And now we can try to solve the model and see what we get. So there's two ways to solve these kind of models. It's quantum mechanics. When you have a gauge theory, you can either first solve the theory and then impose the Gauss's constraint, or you can first impose Gauss's constraint and then solve the theory. So we're going to first solve the system and then impose Gauss's constraint. At this level, you take A0 equals 0, you just get n squared free harmonic oscillators. The system is trivial to solve, and then you can use the letter Z for the matrix-valued raising operator associated to the dynamics of this gauge harmonic oscillator. The full list of states has to be the set of gauge invariant states of this configuration, which when you have Zs with free indices, you have to trace over all indices to make sure that this is UN invariant. And this basically lands you on the configuration where you get traces. And then we can always choose the Ni so that N is greater than or equal than all of the Ni. And then this also makes contact with the counting by Yang-Tableau, meaning that there's some way to make a one-to-one correspondence between these numbers and Yang-Tableau. The difference is that it's a different basis because, as we argued before, traces are not orthogonal, whereas the Yang-Tableau basis is. So all we get this way is that the counting of states is the same, but there's some dictionary between both bases that still needs to be worked out. So We've also reduced the problem to a one-matrix model. We can solve it in a different way, which is first choose a gauge or solve as many of the gauge constraints as we can, and then try to quantize. So we can try to choose a gauge where Z is diagonal. It's an n-by-n matrix. We can make it diagonal. Classically, if you just plug a diagonal ansatz for Z, you get a free harmonic oscillator per eigenvalue. However, if you do the quantum theory, permutations of eigenvalues are part of SUN and have to be gauged. Therefore, you obtain a system of n bosons in the harmonic oscillator to begin with. The second point that you have to remember is that you did a change of variables from diagonal matrices to from generic matrices. When you do changes of variables in quantum mechanics, you have to be careful with the Laplacian because there's a change of measure. So to get the correct Laplacian, you have to take this into account. And the measure factor is well known. It's the volume of the orbit of the matrix Z under gauge transformations. And this is the square of the van der Mond determinant. So what you get for the Hamiltonian is the Laplacian, which is the measure included, plus the master. They're complex, but it's one raising operator, one lowering operator. So it's not an issue in this case. If you count number of degrees of freedom, it's the same as a single harmonic oscillator. Yeah. I'm allowed to do that because I'm only using one of the polarizations of the field Z. So the measure is this product of the differences of the eigenvalue squared. And this is the van der Mond determinant. And then what you can do is you can do a change of basis on your wave functions, where you consider all your wave functions psi to be the inverse of the van der Mond times some psi tilde function. And if you write the effective Hamiltonian for psi tilde, you actually get a free Hamiltonian. Except that because of this delta inverse, this is completely antisymmetric in the eigenvalues. So you've gotten a free Hamiltonian of fermions. So once you get this system, you have n free fermions in the harmonic oscillator, then it's downhill from here in the sense that we all know how to deal with this system. So we have a vacuum. The vacuum is characterized by Fermi energy. It basically means that you stack fermions from the bottom up until you run out of fermions. A complete set of wave functions can be described by Slater determinants of the harmonic oscillator energy eigenstates. And then I'm going to give you a dictionary to Young tableau again. And the way you do it is you take the eigenvalues, you look from the top down, and you subtract the energy of the corresponding eigenvalue in the ground state. And that gives you a set of integers which are strictly non-increasing, actually. It says strictly decreasing, but they're strictly non-increasing. And basically, you associate a Young tableau where you write rows of length ni minus n minus I. And these are the numbers. And when you have a list of n non-increasing numbers, this is the, what you need to characterize a Young tableau. Well, there's another fact of mathematical physics, and this is that this description in terms of fermions coincides exactly with the description based on group characters of Schur polynomials that we had before. And now we have an identification in this system of fermions. A giant graviton growing into radius 5 corresponds to a very long row. That means to take the topmost eigenvalue and give it a lot of energy. So it's just one of the fermions. Okay? A giant graviton on S5 corresponds to raising by one unit a lot of the eigenvalues. And when you look at what that does, it is actually a hole in the Fermi scene. So the D-brains are fermions and holes. And this solves the puzzle. The two types of D-brains are the fermion and the hole. Now, when you have matrix models in the past, in string theory, it has been very useful to consider models in the phase space of the classical system. So from this point of view, we get a fermion system on a two-dimensional space, which is x and t. Now, I can draw the Fermi surface here. It's just a circle. And a 2D phase space can also be associated to the degrees of freedom of a charged particle in a constant magnetic field in the lowest Landau level. The way that happens is that a particle, charged particle in a magnetic field will have some circular trajectory, and then you can ask for the center of that circular trajectory. And it's these center coordinates that have a non-trivial, Poisson bracket, and which give rise to a non-commutative structure when you quantize. So this phase space over here is the same thing as the phase space of electrons in the lowest Landau level, and this is known as the quantum Hall effect. And the way you're supposed to interpret the Hamiltonian is as a perturbation of the lowest Landau level that localizes your electrons into a droplet. So you can talk about the fermions as a droplet. Now, we know a lot about this system. It's very well known. This is the integer quantum Hall effect. We know that you can take electrons. You know that you can make holes. And these are supposed to be our D-brains. And then there's also edge excitation. And the edge excitations are going to be the closed strings, the traces that we had before. So this is the way you set up the dictionary. There's electrons, there's holes, those are D-brains, and there's edge states.
So here's a really nice question. I have a hole and I want to fill it with an electron.
Yes. Well, they don't cancel out because when you add both, you add even more R charge.
Oh, okay.
Right? In that sense, they're not really canceling out. What we know is that the spectrum of excitations coincides with the spectrum of excitations of this system. Adding electrons is adding to N in some sense. Right?
So you're saying so a hole in
Well, you have to go to a grand canonical ensemble to do that in this case, because you need to be able to change the number of electrons of your configuration. Right? If n is fixed, the number of electrons is fixed.
So what's a hole?
A hole is, in the standard description, you have a Fermi C, and it's an excitation where you take an electron from the Fermi C and put it at the edge. Well, you take it from the bottom and put it on the edge. Well, you're not changing the value of n. So you can, let's say, force the system and perturb it and drive it so that they annihilate each other. But they won't do it on its own because these guys are just following classical trajectories over here. So in that sense, they will never find each other. In this case, they're free. They're not interacting. So it's hard to make them annihilate each other. So now that we've, let's say, answered the question from a qualitative point of view, we have some understanding of what these states are, we need to understand how come these D-brains, or how come these states are truly D-brains. So what's a D-brain? It's something where open strings can end on it. And we also know that they have gauge dynamics on the world volume. So I want to show you that you can do both of these things, and that you can do all the things that you think you can do with D-brains on the dual CFT point of view. I'm starting with everything BPS. To add strings, I'm going to make it non-BPS. Well, from the field theory point of view, yes. From the supergravity point of view, you also are adding string stretching between the D-brains. And this is also perturbing away from being BPS. But the perturbation is considered to be small, meaning that there's small back reaction of the D-brains.
Okay, but the matrix model will be more than just the D-brains.
Yes. Now I'm going to reintroduce the rest of Young-Mills. Okay. So the point is that we need to build all the gauge invariant states with the other fields in Young-Mills theory. Okay? So the point is that we need to, let's say, start with our giant graviton and add to it. But we need to add to it in a non-trivial way, meaning that we don't want to add a trace of some of the other stuff. We want to somehow intertwine the giant graviton with the rest of the stuff to make sure that you're building something on the D-brain itself. So let me give you an idea of how you think about building new states. You take a string, which is what we build just a word in the fields, at least in the three field theory. This is how you build it. And then a word with open indices at the end, meaning that you contract all indices except one at the beginning and one at the end. You don't trace over it. You leave some ends free. And then you want to intertwine this upper and lower index that you have left over of this matrix with the indices of Z. So if you had your giant graviton, you start with a Young tableau for Z. And now I'm going to tell you that to add a string to it, you need to build other representations of SUN with this extra matrix that you built out of N equal 4 Young-Mills theorem. And then if you put it, if you take a column and you add a word at the bottom, you can interpret this as adding an open string to a giant graviton. There's some caveat, and this is, you have to be careful. You have to keep track of both upper and lower indices. W is distinguishable from Z. And if you look at the statistics of the upper indices of Z, it has to be mirrored in the statistics of the lower indices for Z because they're bosons. So whatever you draw as a tableau for upper indices is the same as for lower indices when you take Z into account. If we add another matrix, it's not true anymore that upper and lower indices are correlated because we cannot exchange W with Z. They're distinguishable particles, so you get something different. So we have to make some double Young tableau notation, and you have to distinguish how you connect the upper index of W to your graviton configuration, and how you connect the lower index of W to your graviton configuration. So you have to distinguish basically something like this with something like this. To get a gauge invariant state, the two tableaux have to be identical in shape. And this is the statement that one for upper indices, one for lower indices, there is a singlet in their tensor product that's your gauge invariant state. On these guys, you cannot find a singlet in the tensor product, and there's no gauge invariant state associated to that configuration. And then, once you have that, realize that, well, I can add one string, I can add two strings, I can keep on adding to the row. Now, if I have multiple giants, how do I add string stretching between giants, and how do we think about Gauss's law? And here's the caricature. You have two giant gravitons, and I'm just stretching strings from one side to the other one. And these giant gravitons are compact D-brains. This means that when you put a string ending on the giant graviton, there's some amount of net inflow charge that has to be canceled somewhere else in the world volume of the graviton. So there has to be another string going out and stretching back to the original. Okay, so we start with the ones of ADS 5. If you have two giants of different sizes, each corresponds to an eigenvalue, all having high energy. And now let's start with the case of eigenvalues. If you give an eigenvalue high energy, you can treat it semi-classically. And then what you see is that you're supposed to take Z and give it very large values on some diagonal entries. And then this looks just like the Higgs mechanism. Un is broken down to U1 squared cross Un minus 2. The phases of Z1 and Z2 are the position of the giant along S5. And if the phase and norm coincide, then the two rows have equal length, and the symmetry is broken to U2 cross Un minus 2. So this you interpret as the enhanced gauge symmetry when the two D-brains come on top of each other. So for this case, we see that the gauge symmetry of the ADS giants is embedded in the original SUN group. And the problem is that it's very hard to do a semi-classical description for holes, because we don't know it. We don't know how to start from eigenvalues, write a matrix configuration that gives you that semi-classical description of holes. So I have to do a different type of argument. So we want to start thinking about gauge invariance in the sense of Gauss's law. We want to add strings and show that the total charge on each giant is canceled. And we use that as evidence for the existence of a gauge symmetry. So if you have giants along ADS, we can really think of them in terms of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And then there's some bifundamentals, which under un minus 2 cross u1 are massive. And this is just the symmetry breaking pattern. And you mark them with a different color, let's say blue and purple. And you also have to remember that they carry an upper or lower index with respect to this u1 charge, positive or negative. So if you want to add open string stretching between giants, you think of these guys as quarks because they're massive. They transform in the fundamental of un minus 2. And you just add, some type of meson field, which is basically two quarks at the end with some blue in the middle. And then you ask for this state to act on a semi-classical background for the eigenvalues. But what happens is that these quarks are charged under this U1. The U1 is gauged, and the U1 is in a compact space. So we need to be careful. We need to cancel the whole charge. So we need to add a string running in the opposite direction. So this is how you recover Gauss's law, thinking from that point of view. So the gauge symmetry implies that the strings will go back and forth, and there will be no one of the D-brains. And this is what we get. And for ADS giants, the gauge symmetry of ADS is embedded in the UN gauge symmetry. So in this case, it's easy to understand. Now I want to do the same type of story, but for the other giants. So how do we do this for the S5 giants? Well, we start with our tableau. We use the double Young tableau, and we're going to postulate that intertwining the indices of the upper and lower part of the word in different corresponds attaching one end to the string to one giant and then attaching the other end to the other giant. Now, if I just do it this way, as I argued before, this cannot produce a gauge invariant state because the two tableaux have different shape. So a configuration with one string stretching between one giant and the other one is not allowed. However, I can always run things backwards and get to identical Young tableau. So if I put one word stretching from this giant here, I can always make another word stretching back. And now I notice that there is a singlet in this configuration because the two tableau have the same shape. So Winter is saying that we see the realization of Gauss's law in a combinatorial fashion. So the statement is that here you see that you're required to put strings going back in order to make sure that you can build a gauge invariant state. So you can trace the gauge invariance on the S5 giants to the gauge invariance of the original gauge theory, but in a very non-trivial way, because we cannot interpret these as eigenvalues any longer. So you can also see that if you make two giants of identical size, then in some sense there's less states. And the states, if you count them, seem to be in agreement with counting gauge invariant states on a U2 field theory. So this means that we're in business. And one can also show for both types of giant gravitons that you can get the low energy fluctuations of the DBI action. And this is really only known in the case of the maximal S5 giants. In the other cases, for the ones that go into ADS, it's known for all values. It's a statement about the fact that you Higgs your theory and you can calculate the low energy effective field theory of the U1 corner, and that gives you exactly the right counting of states. But for the S5 giants, only the case of the maximal giant is known how to do this. And it turns out that there's some issue of combinatorics that prevents you from doing the same thing in the other case. So let's start with maximal giants. Why would you want to study just the maximal giants? Well, there's a lot of reasons. First of all, it's there, and you can do the calculations there simpler. In supergravity, it's a static brain in global coordinates, which means that it's not moving around. And because of that, it's easier to understand. And it's geometrically the most symmetric configuration, so it's a good place to begin. It's also easy to take a Penrose limit on the world volume of that D-brain, So that's a well-known limit, and we should be able to explain the Penrose limit of the D-brain and understand what happens there. And it also descends to the baryons and the orbifolds. So this is the most similar stuff to baryons in QCD as well. So there's a lot of reasons to study just this guy. So you do it. And now I can just give you explicit forms of the operators. So if I take the maximal giant graviton, it's going to be something with completely anti-symmetric indices in the top and bottom. So I can use the epsilon symbol to guarantee that they're completely anti-symmetric. And the symbols that are left over, you just contract with deltas. So that's your operator that corresponds to the giant graviton of size. Okay. And then there's some simplifying notation, because you see that you are going too many of these things, and your hand gets tired. So you have two epsilon symbols, and you say that you have k uncontracted indices from each one of them. I just saturate them with zens. To add a string, we make the same notation. We now have k plus 1 free indices, and we use this as some type of multilinear operator where we have the w at the end. And this basically guarantees that the indices of w are contracted anti-symmetrically to the indices of z. And now, a definition that you have to be careful about is that a giant is maxical if n minus k is small, meaning that k has to be of order n, but not necessarily exactly equal to n. And the reason is because if you start with epsilon nn, you cannot add an extra anti-symmetric index. So you have to give a little bit of room for that. And basically, if k is of order from 1 to up to square root of n, this definition works. So all of these are going to be basically on top of each other in the geometric limit. N is being taken to infinity. K is small, so it's hard to distinguish to leading order in 1 over n between these guys. Now, I want to show you that you get boundary conditions for strings. And what happens is that for the word w that you add, it's not allowed to begin or end in z, meaning that you overcount states if you allow that, because there's an identity that tells you that ok omega will be equal to ok plus 1 omega prime, meaning chop the z at the beginning or end of the word, plus ok plus 1 trace of omega prime, which you would interpret as a d-brain plus a graviton or some string state. So because of these identities, z is not allowed to be on the edges of w, and you think of that as a Dirichlet-like boundary condition for z inside w. So now we can look at the maximal giant, and now we can do the rest of the story for that one. The rest of the story is we need to show that somehow we get also Dirichlet boundary conditions for all the other directions in ADS5 in some sense. So we need to split the problem into planar and non-planar diagrams. And this is tricky in general, because we're not dealing just with traces. We have large numbers of fields, and there's combinatorial enhancement of one of n squared suppressions. So there's some combinatorial facts for maximal giants. The length of the associated spin chain, which is the language we're going to use, is conserved by planar diagrams to one loop order, and it cannot exchange z's with the giant by planar diagrams. So this is something that you calculate. It's true to first order in perturbation theory. And the second order, and the second point to notice is that planar diagrams inside W are the same planar diagrams in n equal 4. So you get exactly the same type of story that people have been writing about in n equal 4 Yang-Mills theory, meaning you get the same SU2/4 integrable spin chain model of n equal 4 Yang-Mills theory. So the inside of the string is the same string that we're used to in ADS5 crosses 5. And the only thing we have to worry about are the edges. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit of what happens at the boundary. When you count planar diagrams, you can have things that count as planar diagrams by contracting indices of the determinants with the word w via interactions. So these things are not allowed for the free field theory calculation. But at one loop, these guys actually contribute to the level of planar diagrams. And these give you boundary conditions for your fields. So you can obtain the full open string chain model for the SO6 sector, let's say, easily. And I already argued that the boundary conditions for Z were Dirichlet type because I was not allowed to put Z at the boundary. For Z bar, you are allowed to put it at the boundary, but you get a lot of energy from being at the boundary via these interactions. So Z bar is also not allowed at the boundary, not because of combinatorics, but because of dynamics. So both of these guys have Dirichlet boundary conditions. This is exactly what you expect from doing strings in ADS5 process 5, that the Z directions are going to be Dirichlet. Now, the ground state for spin chain of length L gets no planar one loop anomalous dimension. And this lets you reproduce the DBI fluctuations and take a Penrose limit, meaning that these are the guys that are not with Zs, but with some other complex field. Y to the L has no planar one loop anomalous dimension. These are the massless guys on the world of the D-brain. And you can understand them and take a Penrose limit and do all the usual.
But Penrose limit, you mean the words have small numbers of impurities?
Meaning L goes to order square root of N, and you have small numbers of impurities. More importantly, the open spin chain that you get has actually interval boundary conditions. So you can do better than just taking the Penrose limit. You can do these whole Bethe ansatz story. So basically, you can play the same games that you play with closed strings in N equal 4. And you can, in principle, do all the standard tricks. OK. Now, let's go back to the half PPS guys. I've already argued that when the D-brains have to be D-brains, they're D-brains. Now, let's see what happens when we try to put a lot of D-brains on top of each other. So the statement I want to make is, can we more or less understand these D-brains in the same way that we understand the ADS-CFT, meaning that when you put a lot of D-brains on top of each other, you can replace them by supergravity? So can we consider really all the supergravity related to D-brain configuration of this type? Now, what's the experience in terms of this stuff? Experience dictates that supergravity can describe coherent states of gravity waves and large collections of coinciding D-brains. And from the fermion droplet point of view, these are described by two-dimensional drawings in two colors. You cannot really put fermions on top of each other because of Fermi statistics, but you can condense them into droplets. So that's the closest you can get them to each other, and then you can have various shapes in this quantum plane. So the problem is, consider all half EPS solutions of supergravity with asymptotic ADS5 cross S5 boundary conditions. Now that's exactly what Lin Lunin and Maldacena did, and then they just started with the following arguments. You look at the symmetries that are preserved by these operators, you get an SO4 cross SO4 cross R symmetry. The SO4 cross SO4 are just rotation R chart associated to the unbroken R. The other SO4 is just from rotations on the S3 that we're compactifying on. The extra R, the translation, time translation symmetry, is associated to a BPS bound. So you can make an ansatz that includes all of this isometry group information in it. You have two or three spheres with some radii. You have some time direction with some additional potential. You cannot involve these angles in the function that you get over here. And then you have some three-dimensional metric for three coordinates that are left over. And then on top of that, you also have to split your flux into f mu nu d omega 3 plus f mu star d omega 3 prime. And you know that you're only going to get five form flux because you only have added d3 brains to your configuration. So they only source five form flux. Now, g, h, v only depend on x, 1, 2, 3. And these ansatz just use all the symmetries of the system that are bosonic. And then if you add supersymmetry to the story, you get a whole bunch of extra mess. So what they did is, they use spinner analysis to construct various conserved forms. And then with these objects, they find a special coordinate y, which is filled out by supersymmetry and corresponds to the product of the radii of the spheres. And it has to be positive. So when y is equal to 0, one of the two spheres is contracting. And that depends on the values of these functions that we get at that point. The final details are complicated. It's a long supergravity story. But I can at least show you the equations. Everything boils down to the following type of configuration. Your metric is written in terms of this function h and g, and there's this coordinate y. H to the minus 2 is 2y times the hyperbolic cosine of g. So if you know g, you know h. The derivatives of v are associated to derivatives of a single scalar function, which is hyperbolic tangent of g times 1 half. So knowing g or z, you can reconstruct v from these equations. And basically, everything boils down to a single function z. And from this line over here and this line from here, you can take some derivatives, and you can show that z satisfies a generalized Laplace-like equation, a partial differential equation, which is linear. So basically, the whole problem of finding supergravity solutions is reduced to finding a single function z which satisfies this equation, which is some Laplace-like equation. So we know how to solve these problems, but there's a catch. The catch is that y equals 0 is special, as I argued before. It's the point of the geometry where the radius generates. It can, y cannot become negative. So to have singularity-free solutions, the function z has to take special values when y is equal to 0. All the values lead to cone-like singularities, because that means that the geometry is not the geometry of something in spherical coordinates properly calibrated. You still have this cone singularity at the bottom. So in these units, and with all the Feynman hyperbolics and all that stuff, there are two special values of z that correspond to the generations of these two free spheres. And they have values plus minus 1 half. And then basically, given z of the boundary, it can be revealed in the interior of the x1, x2, y geometry because of this partial differential equation. So it's a Laplace-like problem with prescribed boundary conditions. And then it's something well understood. The boundary y equals 0 is two-dimensional, x1 and x2, and it's painted in two colors. So what Lin-Lunin and Maldacena said is these configurations correspond exactly with this quantum plane description I gave before in terms of fermions. So when you do that, you get pictures like this, ugly two-dimensional droplets. And then there's some topology story where you just notice that if you take some object over here, some contour around one of these droplets, there's a sphere that degenerates here. I can lift this contour and make some type of cap in three dimensions. And then I can look at the vibration of this three sphere over this disk topology. And then it turns out that what you get is a topological S5. And then this is a non-contractible phi sphere. So what you see is that when you have more than one I over here in these configurations, you have more than one non-contractible phi sphere. So yes. Yeah, and it's a topologically non-trivial cycle because you replace the d-brains by flux.
Right.
So the point is that you have changed the topology just by studying these half EPS solutions. And I think Peter will tell you a little bit more about that. And then, in some sense, the lesson you're supposed to draw from this is that supersymmetric MLs sums over topologies automatically because these droplet configurations are just semi-classical states in some sense. There's always quantum fluctuations that can change your shape and add extra holes and stuff like that that are suppressed by quantum effects, but they're non-negligible. So in some sense, this is the physical realization of the quantum form of Wheeler, where each droplet is a topological bubble of space-time, meaning some non-trivial topology associated to it. And you can even argue that for very small defects close to another droplet, they dissolve, meaning that they're better described as ordinary gravitons in the geometry, meaning some perturbation of your edge geometry. And this is from the quantum Hall point of view, the fact that edge states are the best description of the low energy dynamics for very small energy configurations.
Well, put it, Cyprian wheels on a sphere, and you know that the d-brain should be there. Does it have to be true?
Well, the point is that the D-brains, I've talked about them semi-classically, but when you really think about them quantum mechanically, they are not always localized exactly where you say they are. They have some quantum spread. There's some infinitesimal probability that they're just part of the other droplet and stuff like that.
But in fact, we're summing over topologies in this sense.
Yes. Yeah, we were summing over topologies, but in some sense, the classical D-brain configuration has a fixed topology. At the quantum level, we know that these drawings are just caricatures of the thermodynamic limit, and we know how to include 1/n corrections in the story because we have the full quantum description of these half BPS states from the N fermions in the harmonic oscillator point of view.
And this is a statement again on the with the superdiagonal radio quantization.
Yeah. So here, the lesson you're supposed to extract is that we have a hint of how quantum gravity works. Including all the sum over topologies and everything. It's a fairly roundabout way, but we are understanding the quantum system in detail. If you just had the two-dimensional drawing picture and you didn't have the story on the CFT point of view, we wouldn't know what to do about the quantum theory still, because...
I agree. Okay.
So in this sense, this is a lot of progress in quantum gravity. So this is the talk. What can we do in the future, or what's the best hope? There's a lot of interesting information in half BPS states. That's what I was arguing today. It can probably be generalized to quarter BPS and maybe 1/8 BPS states. 1/2 BPS is like n equal 4 in 4 dimensions. That usually lets you solve everything. 1/4 BPS is like n equal to 2 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. That lets you solve for some things. And 1/8 BPS state is like n equal 1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions, which also lets you solve for some things, but less. So maybe part of this story can go all the way to half, to quarter and 1/8 BPS states. And then the question you have to ask is there a nice matrix model description of these states? Can one write the spectrum of fluctuations of any of these geometries in the supergravity side and do the calculation in field theory and get it to match? It's a very non-trivial calculation, right? You have these complicated harmonic functions. It's a complicated metric. In principle, the description of, let's say, gravity states on these configurations is rather non-trivial. And then we would like to be able to reproduce that using the dual CFT point of view. Now, there's all these, let's say, topology changes. We know that there's some relation to confinement. This is confinement in 0 dimensions, not in 4 dimensions. But maybe there's some lessons to be learned. There's also the issue of understanding when does this droplet picture break down in the sense of can we understand the Tuft expansion in detail and understand what happens when these two droplets are approaching each other to see what happens when we're doing the topology changes. It's a very interesting question that we can try to answer. Of course, there's many more questions because this is just a starting point to try to do systematic analysis of let's say, quantum gravity in this case systematically and try to understand how does the CFT teach you something about what happened in ADS. Questions?
Yes. Is I go down in numbers of supersymmetries, I know that at least at the state of 1/8, something dramatic can have to happen in the final rising place.
I think they start at 1/16 BPS, but I'm not sure. Harvey hasn't told me all the details. 1/16 half black holes. 1/8, I am not sure they do yet. I think it's half BPS in 4 supercharges, which is 1/16. I think so. Yeah.
You're talking about these operators in the Yang-Mills theory, and presumably you talk about after your GPS, you're thinking about a weak coupling story.
Yeah, but this
how
is
much of the deep brain picture do you expect to kind of carry over? I mean, if
well,
you sort of say some words about looking for DBI actions.
Well, looking for DBI actions is not bad because those are things with very low energy, meaning close to zero. So they're very close to BPS. These are things that you expect to be protected to leading order, right? Something like that. Not necessarily BMN. It's more like the supergravity story, that we understand supergravity states and the low energy fluctuations. Right. You need to put a little bit more effort into that because you know that you want to really understand the string interactions. So you need to keep the leading order non-planar stuff to start to see, let's say, the DBI non-linear terms.
But it's true that one should be careful about exactly which excitations you're considering.
Yeah. What you hope to do is reproduce the energies of the DBI spectrum with the non-linear interactions included. So if you have the quadratic fluctuations, that's a beginning, and then you want to do one loop interactions and hope that you keep on finding some agreement. And maybe that's all you'll find. But maybe something survives. It still needs to be understood how to do it in any case.
OK, we should break the coffee. I forgot to say earlier, there are some computer accounts. The details are up on the blackboard here. And there's various terminals in there, and the wireless connection should be working also.